Hello, I'm Simon Burton and welcome to Arts Roundup on Cambridge 105, a journey to discover the arts activity happening in every corner of Cambridge, where we'll investigate strange goings-on by a bunch of badly dressed robots with attitude, get to grips with some stunning portraiture, and delve into the art of making show-stopping pottery. In this edition, we investigate a motley gang of talking robots in King Street and meet their creator, scrap artist Giles Walker. Portrait artist Heloise Toop talks about her work and capturing inner light. Professional potter Katerina Klug previews the Anglian Potters exhibition. We look at the lineup for the Romsey Arts Festival with Catherine Lullaby. And author Gail Walker introduces her new book on meditation techniques. If you were walking down King Street in the last few weeks, you probably noticed a large shop window with a pair of peculiar life-size pink robots sitting in the window, moving and enjoying a coffee, or perhaps a robot dog with an old telephone for a head sitting on the pavement wagging and nodding. It's the imaginative work of scrap artist Giles Walker and was designed to arouse curiosity for the main show inside, where a team of robots, which look like something from the post-apocalyptic films Mad Max or Waterworld, enjoy a conversation depicting a humorous reworking of The Last Supper. Giles, who painstakingly created the robots, introduced the 10-minute animated robot show, which features plenty of dried ice smoke and special effects.
She's over there.
Those beautiful eyes.
We'll find you.
Who made that disgusting noise? Was it you?
Was it you?
Was it you? How dare you? You have made a very, was it very you? Big mistake. Glorious assumption. Must be named Mary, Virgin Mother. Must be St. Joseph of most Jesus. Must be God and his angels and his
saints. Was it you?
Glorious assumption. Must be named Mary, Virgin Mother. Must be St. Joseph of most Jesus. I tell you, the floodgates have been opened, and it is our duty to see that they are firmly closed again. But you know that, don't you?
Giles, tell me about yourself. How did you become someone who manipulates robots for art?
Well, I started about 20 years ago. I joined up with the Toyed Waste Company, a group of sort of scrap artists, and we sort of travelled around squatting different warehouses, and the deal was we bought in scrap and we built art out of it. And I got discovered windscreen wiper motors, and from there I sort of started putting them in the sculptures, making it move. And yeah, over the 20 years it's kind of developed from there.
Do you come from a science background? Why have robots interested you particularly?
To be honest, I'm not particularly interested in the technological side. I do it as a sort of means to an end, and it is, you know, it adds a little fun element when if you're not a perfectionist, which is I'm not, you know, you make it how you think it's going to work best, and then you fire it up and it never comes out as you planned. So each robot has its own characteristic just by mistake. But
I mean, there seems to be a lot of people who want to cross over the barrier between sort of sciences and art by using robots for things like this. Can you describe a couple of the robots you've got here? Because you've got some outside who are having tea at a table.
Yeah.
You've got another one which has got an enormous telephone for a head. And yet they seem quite human in the way that they move. Is it hard to get that kind of across like that?
Depends what you concentrate on, because you know, you can build a robot, you can make a robot do anything if you can spend enough money on it. You know, the Japanese spend millions on robots and they move almost like humans, but to me they're not like humans, they're like the sort of walking dead. Whereas the robots I do, I spend very little money on because it's due to budget restrictions, and so I concentrate on the smallest of movements that I think portrays a person's characteristics. So a little hand twitch, the way they hold a cigarette, a little nod of the head, is that, or how they scratch the back of their leg with their other foot, is that's what I concentrate on.
Obviously they're dressed up as characters that look like something out of Mad Max here, but they've also, I mean, they're made from mannequins presumably, and the motors that run things on cars like windscreen wipers and things like that. I mean, have you just experimented to put these together like this? Because they're quite incredible.
I'd say this particular piece, there wasn't a lot of experimental. It was pretty well planned out. I kind of knew what I was doing from day one. Not visually, but mechanically I knew what I was doing, yeah.
what we've got here is it's tremendously dark and room with lots of candles and some 14 or 15 robots that move 13. Here. 13 robots. And some of them look like something out of post-apocalyptic fiction. They also have that look of perhaps being the crew of the Mary Celeste or something. Where did the idea come for this?
Well, obviously it's the Last Supper. It's based around the Last Supper. And I wanted to... it's really hard to explain because actually it took a year to build, and over the year the ideas changed and developed and things changed. So the idea of it being a ship came about halfway through building. I'd already built the table and stuff, but I then sort of decided I was going to make it wonky, chop a few legs off, stick a mast on it, and a steering wheel, have Jesus steering. That's quite an old religious metaphor, actually, you know, like the ship that carries, religion being a ship that carries sort of the lost souls across purgatory to heaven.
Okay, you've got the figure at the head of the table here, yeah. Which is supposed to be Jesus at the Last Supper.
Some
but it looks
say,
rather more like Marlon Brando at the Last Supper, doesn't it?
This was a kind of a little twist on the fact that, you know, the Hollywood portrayal of Jesus is always this kind of handsome man with kind of very sort of muscly and with long hair. And actually, there's zero proof that is the case. So I thought, you know, we'll go for a fat bald one, and because you know, what difference does it make?
Okay, now they make these wonderful gestures. They move around during the show, but they also say things. What are they saying?
I think the dialogue was the hardest bit of the whole project. It took me about 3 months because it was like I'd built the cast of a play but hadn't written the play. And when you're building sculpture that makes sound, especially if you want to put dialogue in, it's really important that it's something that you can listen to again and again and again. So I was concentrating much more on sort of feeling and rhythm and texture of the sound. So I sampled lots of bits of different films. I also recorded a lot of my own voice and put it through voice manipulation so it wasn't recognisable, and sort of glued it all together. And the sort of general thing is this kind of feeling of interrogation, implied guilt, threat, sense of violence running underneath it, and that's kind of all I wanted to get.
It's in a darkened room with candles, but there's also dry ice and smoke drifting around, which gives it a slightly ghostly air. Was that what you intended to do?
Yes, because it's the sort of idea of this sort of ship being lost on a you know, in the fog, kind of just drifting, really not really knowing what it's going. But it's quite interesting because before I've shown it in Cambridge, I've always shown it in really massive spaces, so it has, you sort of walk in and see it in the middle of this kind of fog looming out, whereas this is much more claustrophobic type feeling, so it's going to have the feeling of kind of being below deck type.
And great costumes. You've got sort of fighter pilots, leather caps, you've got berets, you've got leather objects, some of them look as though they're wearing almost armour and things like that.
Yeah, I wanted them to sort of be journeymen, you know, like whether they be pilots or sailors, just that kind of that feeling of those sort of an old crew, you know, who were sitting it out on a boat.
You're also collecting money for Jimmy's Night Shelter, aren't you?
We opened the whole show with a private view for the homeless of Cambridge, and Jimmy's basically invited the sort of homeless community of Cambridge to come and have a free meal and originate. This is an events caterer. They did all the food for free and basically laid on this amazing feast, and it was best opening I've ever done. I think it was a kind of knee-jerk reaction from LA, where it was all a bit too hair and makeup, and I wanted to do something a bit with a sense a bit more real. I've got another exhibition opening in November in London, a brand new one that I'd like to bring here probably early next year if possible.
Charles Walker, what a fantastic show. Thank you very much.
Thank
indeed.
You.
Having a portrait painted of yourself or someone you love can be a very personally significant affair and can be a treasured heirloom, capturing something important in the heart as life goes inexorably on. Lots of people do it, but few are able to get at the inner intelligence of the subject as well as the beauty in just one sitting. As I discovered artist Heloise Toop does with her remarkable style and talent, creating bold, unambiguous and colourful portraits in oil and acrylic. She's just finished a successful open studios and took time out to talk about her work.
Looking at your amazing portrait painters here in your studio, it seems to me that we have someone dressed as someone from Alice in Wonderland.
Yes, that actually started, the Alice in Wonderland one started because my sister does have a really quirky dress sense, and she actually did just have that outfit lying around. And then I did that one and thought, oh, it's quite Alice in Wonderland-y, and kind of put in a nice background, and then the series kind of led on from that, and I've done other characters since.
And you've got Red Riding Hood, who looks a bit more like a very rustic Red Riding Hood figure there. And also, is it Snow White at the end? Or?
It's Goldilocks with the bears. So the Red Riding Hood is my sister's friend Rachel, who's a bit punky, and we actually went and did that in Cherry Hinton Hall.
Do you like adding an element? I mean, obviously, your portraits draw on people's inner character, as I can see clearly from these faces, but do you like to add an element of fantasy?
Occasionally, yes, I do, especially with this series. I just think they're much more interesting, and also people are more drawn to portraits with a kind of narrative aspect to it, unless they're commissions where it's just a face and, you know, they know the person. So.
What do you try to capture with one of these? When you see somebody, how does the process work between creating an image of this sort and initially meeting them for a sitting, as it were?
Basically, I'll approach people that I think are interesting looking to pose for portraits, but I find everyone interesting, so I'll take lots of photos and we'll just pick one together for commissions.
They're very large as well. Large, very colourful, obviously exaggerated character. What sort of medium and paints are you using for this?
I'm using oil paints. Do use acrylic sometimes. I've very recently done some acrylics, but oils are my favourite.
Got quite a number of characters here. Who are they? Where are they from? You have a celebrity here I see on the wall.
Yes, I have Brian Bellow, who some of you might know from Big Brother a few years ago. He won it and he's on TV quite a lot, but I know him through my sister, so that was a lucky break for me. And then I have lots of family members. My brother, my sister is in a lot of them because she's got such a funny dress sense, so she's kind of a brilliant person to paint. And then just friends. And
so how long does a sitting like this take? I mean, with Brian there, you've got him at his face at a beautiful angle there. How long would it take you to complete one like that?
That one took probably about 4 weeks on and off.
Portraiture, what was it that drew you towards it in the first place as an artist?
It's hard to know exactly when, but I just remember always being interested in it, so it must have just been ingrained from an early age.
Portraits, as far as I can see, are very, very personal things that become eventually family heirlooms. And they capture people at various stages in their lives. Is that something that touches you as an artist as well, that you're actually creating a lasting bond with the person that you do it with? Or?
Definitely, yes. Yeah. It's so important to get people looking, you know, really like them and capturing the essence of them at that time, because I know it will be around for a really long time, mm-hmm. So you have to do a good job.
Like, you're very young. How old are you exactly?
I'm 27.
27, and how long have you been doing it for?
Well, I've been interested all my life, but I really took it seriously from about 17. Yeah, so 10 years.
What do you look for when you look at your subjects? Do you try and kind of get a sort of profile, to get something in it, to capture something in them that you sort of base or hang the portrait on, as it were? What do you do when you look at the people? How do you try to read them?
Well, I always insist on meeting the people and taking my own photos, because I have to meet them in order to kind of get any kind of personality across. I can't do it from someone else's picture. So I'm not sure really. I think just talking to them and just seeing if they're kind of confident or a bit withdrawn and shy, and you just kind of get it through like that, and obviously pick out beautiful features like eyes and mouth.
And obviously photography is all about capturing the inner light in the subject, and a good photographer gets it just right, and I think it's similar with portraiture, isn't it, that if you can get some glimmer of their character into the image, then the whole thing stands up beautifully.
Definitely. You have to have something more than just a likeness.
So you actually take a photograph of the person and then just work from there. Yeah.
I take several. I'll probably take about 40 to 50 and then we'll discuss together after I've picked kind of 5 or 6 that I think will work. We'll pick from that. But then I also have all the other ones as reference. So it's kind of like they're there. And I can always call them back.
How long does it take to complete one?
It really varies on size and medium, but generally I say about a month.
Absolutely fabulous. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Just that I am available for commissions. Just look up my website. I'll be happy to answer any questions anyone's got. And thanks very much.
And the website is at?
It's www.eloisetoupe.com.
Eloise, thank you very much indeed for talking to Cambridge 105.
You're listening to Arts Roundup on Cambridge 105.
If you've ever fancied giving pottery a spin, it's the perfect time of year to get inspired, as 400 talented local pottery and ceramics artists celebrate 30 years of the Anglian Potters. The event at Emmanuel College runs between August the 20th and September the 4th, and features everything from outrageous animals, grotesque caricatures from fairy tales, through to elegant and beautiful pieces for the home. I dropped in on professional potter and show organiser Katerina Klug at her Cambridge studio to preview the show and find out why her beautiful works were recently featured in Good Homes magazine.
Katerina, we're here in this rather splendid studio at the bottom of your garden. You've got some wonderful spinning wheels and lots of beautiful finished pots. What a place to talk about the forthcoming Anglian Potters exhibition, which is happening in Emmanuel College, isn't it?
That is right. Yes, we are all preparing for the exhibition, which is coming up next month. And yes, here in my studio, some pots are ready and some aren't.
Now, they are quite a zany bunch, the potters, aren't they? What does it take to become a potter and why do people take it up?
That's a good question. I think different people have different ways to come to clay. Some are introduced to the material maybe at school. In my case, it was my mother. She's a professional potter as well. And other people just later in life take it up as a hobby and realize how wonderful it is to work with this material and take it then to the next level.
Is there a range of materials that you can use? I mean, different kind of types of pottery, or is it all basically the same process, or how does it work?
Well, chemically it's all the same, but you can get stoneware, earthenware, porcelain, and they have different colours and different ranges of temperatures to fire them to. But in the end of the day, it all starts with a lump of clay and your idea.
So you take your lump of clay and you drop it onto one of these beautiful spinning wheels. What happens then? It wobbles, it gets wet and it goes round. How do you actually develop the skill to turn that into something really quite remarkable, like some of the things we've got around us?
So first I have a lump of soft clay and I throw it with a good smack onto my wheel, onto the wheel head, and then you need a bit of water so you don't get a friction on your hands between the hands and the clay. And then with the movement of the wheel, which is a spinning movement, you manipulate with your hands the shape, and hopefully in a skillful way, and hopefully the outcome is a usable pot.
Okay, so you've got your pot, which you've carefully handcrafted together. Then you have the trouble of glazing it, don't you?
Yes. Well, there's a little bit in between. So we air dry it first, and then it goes in the firing the first time, which is the bisque firing, which is a lower temperature to about 900 to 1000 degrees.
And these are the kilns over here?
That's right. I have three different ones because the smallest one is for my test pieces. I do a lot of glaze development, and so the small one gives me quick results. The medium one is my older lady. She has been with me for a long time and she only goes to a low temperature. And then the newest addition, which I'm very happy with, is a kiln that goes to a very high temperature, which makes the glazes melt. With the porcelain I use, I need to fire it at least to 1,260 degrees.
Wow. And then, I mean, the finished products look absolutely amazing. They've got all kinds of wonderful patterns. Where do you draw the inspiration from your patterns? Or are they just completely something that you came up with?
Well, a lot comes from nature. My studio is in the garden, so I look at my garden and at plants that are in front of it, and they grow along the year, and that's one big inspiration for me.
So the theme there is something like camouflage, isn't it, in natural things, like the stripes on a zebra or something like that, or on a tabby cat?
Yes, or in the white stripes, I think you're talking about. I see them as birch trees at night, so this design is called Moonlight Birch Tree.
They're aesthetically and visually absolutely beautiful. What a tremendous set. So how long does it take to create a piece like one of these vases here?
From start to finish, it takes about a fortnight, but there are phases in between where it just dries or where it's in a kiln. So while one piece is in one process state, I go to the next pot or to the next piece.
How did you become the spokesperson organizer for the Anglian Potters exhibition? Is that something you've been involved with for some time now?
I was lucky enough to become selected member this year. As a professional, you have the option, or if you are really committed to the craft, you can apply for selected membership, and I got it, which is very nice. And so I thought, I need to get involved more, I need to give back to the organization more, and so I'm helping out now with organizing the exhibition.
But there are some really wacky things in the exhibition, aren't there? There are huge caricature faces, there are things that resemble objects, birds, animals, things from Beatrix Potter. It really is really a very colourful show, isn't it?
Absolutely. It ranges from sculpture, from objects for the garden, for the house, things you can use, but the things that just take your fancy and are expressions of, you know, really exciting ideas.
Now, it's great to have Emmanuel College as the venue because it's a particularly lovely one, isn't it?
Oh, we're very grateful to be there year after year, and the college is very supportive to our exhibition. And it's a beautiful venue. It's just a wonderful, the old library is just a wonderful room for us.
Now, how long does it go on for? Because it's quite a long time, isn't it, that it stretches over?
Yes, it goes until the 4th of September, and it starts on the 20th of August. And our private view is on the 19th of August. You can become a member of the Anglian Potters. It's an open organization. And through the Anglian Potters, you will find that lots of our members are teaching the craft. And also, if you go to our website, you will find lots of information around it.
It's anglianpotters.org.uk. And your website is?
Mine is Katharina. Klug-art.com.
If you want to see Katharina in action, you can actually see film clips of throwing and spinning pottery on a wheel in her studio, so you can actually see the place that we're talking from. It's Katharina, brilliant stuff, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
Mill Road and its attached streets in Cambridge were recently tipped in the national press as one of the most up-and-coming and vibrant neighbourhoods in the country to live in. And there'll be no shortage of action there over the next 2 weeks, as today sees the opening of the Romsey Arts Festival. Over 30 venues are showcasing all manner of inspiring work, and we'll be promoting arts activities and networking events aimed at integrating arts activity across the south of the city. Here's social media organiser for the festival, Catherine Lullaby.
Art can be so welcoming and really all-encompassing, and we're trying to create events that really are accessible to everyone of all ages and all backgrounds, whatever kind of things they're interested in.
What was the core concept that triggered it, though?
Well, I think the idea with the Romsey Art Festival, it just felt like there was so much happening in Romsey and no way to sort of celebrate it or to bring it all together. You know, like there were artists all over Romsey, but there was nothing that sort of celebrated it. So we thought, you know, if we create this festival, we can find a platform to sort of bring out all the artists and make sure, you know, everybody knows what's actually happening in Romsey, which is a lot.
Which venues are participating? Obviously, Cambridge Arts Salon is the main hub, but there are other places like Williams Art involved.
We've got a list of about 30 venues. That's a lot of venues. Yeah. We've got a lot. We've got Williams Art, we've got Hot Numbers, we've got the Black Cat Cafe, we've got the Junction, we've got the Drawing Cube, we're changing spaces on Norfolk Street, we've got CB1 Cafe, we've got Six Bells, we've got the Empress, we've got St. Barnabas Press, Romsey Mill, Limoncello, and the list goes on and on.
Obviously, it's going to be high expectations that this will be a highly successful event. It's been well organised, it's got a lot of people involved, loads of things to go and see. But how important is it really for developing the arts in this end of the city? Do you think that the festival will just go on and on?
I think it will, because I think, you know, Cambridge has a lot to offer, and, you know, people think of Cambridge, they think of the university, but they don't necessarily associate it with, you know, all the arts that it has to offer. And I think with this festival, it's going to really bring it forward and put, you know, bring a lot more attention to the artists in Cambridge and in Romsey especially.
Bringing more footfall to Romsey for that purpose will be very good for selling art. Mm. But what's the money side of it like for artists at the moment? Economic
it's
low tide?
It's not great. It's really not great.
Trying to sell, you know.
It's very difficult. Because, you know, there are exhibiting opportunities and stuff like that, but money is tight for everyone. Not everybody can, you know, afford to splash out on art and things like that. So the idea is for basically artists like myself as well to downsize their work, to create small pieces of artwork, sort of token pieces that are accessible and affordable, sort of more within the £20 to £30 range rather than, you know, a few hundred pounds. You know, so it's kind of making it more accessible, but still, you know, trying to get your foot in the door that way.
Can you tell me a little bit about some of the highlights of the festival
I was looking through the list of the events earlier, actually. For me, the highlights are all the networking events that we've got. We've got two key ones, which are, let's see, there's the Independent Cambridge Meetup. And Independent Cambridge is this little book that was created last year, and it's, it basically highlights all the independent stores in Cambridge. And it's going to be a talk at Urban Larder, and this is basically just going to be about all the little indie stores that we have in Cambridge and in Romsey, and just celebrating that, which is going to be really great. And another one is Community Lover's Guide to Cambridge. Like, I don't know if you've heard of Community Lover's Guide to book. It's kind of like you get them for lots of different cities. You've got like Amsterdam, Paris, and it's basically about the community but not what tourists see. Mm. You know, it's more about how people live and more sort of bohemian side of things.
Now, Rumsey obviously as an area was very run down in the 1970s, but now it's actually becoming very cosmopolitan and vibrant, isn't it?
I think it was in the Times and the Guardian, it was like one of the best areas to live was Mill Road. And I was like, okay, fine, why not?
Okay, now dates. When does it kick off and when does it finish?
It starts this Saturday on the 3rd of August. Mm. So it actually starts at about 10 a.m. with events all over the place. There's events at the Cambridge Art Salon and Hope Street Yard all day long. And there's also film screenings at Rumsey Labour Club with the Cambridge Cinema Shorts, as well as lots of other things going on.
And then it runs until?
The 17th of August.
Yeah, 17th of August, yes.
And that's when our closing party is at St. Philip's Church.
Is there a programme for the whole event that people can get?
Yes, there is meant to be a programme, and it is available at Cambridge Art Salon. And it will be distributed over the next few days around Cambridge. And of course, all the events can be seen online at our website and on our blog.
You're listening to Arts Roundup on Cambridge 105.
It often comes up in conversation that to be a good artist, you need to be in touch with your inner self, and a spot of meditation can help you to reach the inner realm and make you feel healthier and at peace with your life. There are many kinds of meditations, spanning the spectrum of religion and through into the more outlandish New Age beliefs, and there's evidence of the latter that even great artists like William Blake used it over 100 years ago to heighten his spiritual and creative powers and leave us his astonishing poetry and paintings. I've been hearing about a new book, Beyond Angels, by author Gail Walker, who has 30 years of experience in the field, which looks at quick routes to reaching transcendence in meditation for those who understand it in all its mysticism. Here, she talks briefly about Beyond Angels, currently hitting the shelves of the spiritual sections in Waterstones and Heffer's bookshops.
I do remember once hearing a story about a self-realised person, an enlightened person, who maintained this level of inner peace and silence all the time. And she had a number of devotees, and one of her devotees was a photographer who used to go travel around and take photographs. And he used to ask her constantly, how can I achieve this liberation, this inner stillness and happiness through my photography? And every time that he asked this question, it was ignored and ignored and ignored. And he couldn't get any answers about why he was ignored until he suddenly realised himself that it wasn't through any activity on the outer plane of life that he was going to achieve this, but it was through inner activity, inner search. I have always felt from being a child that there was something more to life. And, of course, I didn't know what that something was. But at the age of 14, I actually took myself off to church on my own. My family didn't go to church. There was no family history of attending church. And I felt, after the experience of going to church, I didn't feel very satisfied by it. I felt that it was a wonderful experience for an hour at a time, but I came away feeling that really there must be more. There must be something more that makes you feel some sort of peace or some sort of inner peace for longer periods of time. And I wasn't satisfied. You know, maybe had there been some vicar there who knew about the potential for human consciousness, who would have been able to help me to meditate or realise this level of peace within, perhaps I would have remained with the church and stayed on that route. But there wasn't, and I continued to search. I didn't feel satisfied. And I felt very much still that there was something out there that would help me. So I just continued to search and investigated all sorts of techniques. And at the age of 18, a non-religious systematic meditation was the one that I chose. The Beyond Angels isn't a book about the New Age and its sort of socio-economic position in society. It's a book about my observations of New Age practices, predominantly healing and meditation over the last years. But definitely my experience of practicing meditation every day. And here I must say, there are many different sorts of meditation, and that is one of the predominant themes of the book, that not all of them are as effective as others. And a meditation which is transcendent or transcendental is much more profound and effective. Because we have this level in, these 40 years of my meditating has taught me that we have this transcendent level within, this level of silence and peace. And it is the purest part of us, it's the eternal part of us. And if you practice a transcendental technique, that has a direct connection to it. It's a much more profound connection for achieving this awareness. The book was predominantly written for Reiki and spiritual healers in order for them to help them raise their practice, make their practice more profound than it already is. So yes, there is quite a bit of information in there that will relate to healing and meditation. But I do hope it is a benefit for other people too, because it should be a benefit for the true seeker and for therapists to help them improve their general therapy practice. You know, reflexologists or Indian head massages can add this and incorporate this into their practice. The quick route that I'm expounding is a meditation which is transcendent even over and above art or any outer activity. I'm due to give a short talk about the writing of Beyond Angels at Wood Green Animal Shelter at 1:30 on Saturday, 31st of August, and I'd also be there on Sunday, 1st of September, and I'll be happy to talk to anyone who may be interested either in the book or in learning to meditate. And of course, I'll be signing and selling the book there too.
It's time to take a look at a pick of what's going on in the city in the next few weeks. If you're an experienced artist and could really use an extra $5,000 about now, Addenbrooke's Hospital is currently appealing for submissions for a large-scale artwork to commemorate the life-changing gift made by organ donors. All mediums are considered, and Damien Hebron is the man to contact for an artist brief. Award-winning novelist Zadie Smith will make a public appearance in Cambridge on August the 21st at the Wordfest to read from and discuss her much-acclaimed new book, NW. An introductory talk on the current exhibition of charismatic artist Christopher Wood is being given by Kettle's Yard director Andrew Nern on August the 22nd, a chance to find out about gallery founder Jim Eade's artistic vision and the Parisian avant-garde of the 1920s. Shakespeare's Globe perform at Corpus Christi College Gardens on August the 21st with The Taming of the Shrew, and Cambridge Shakespeare Festival offers much more Shakespeare in the College Gardens over August, with Richard III at St John's, Hamlet at Trinity, The Two Gentlemen of Verona at Robinson College, and A Midsummer Night's Dream at Homerton College. And that's all we have time for in this edition of Arts Roundup. I'm Simon Burton, and I hope you enjoyed listening in on Cambridge 105, and we'll get in touch if you have an arts story to tell.